I'm Luke Landis, and this is the Consumerism Commentary Podcast. Today's guest, Jamie Tardy, the eventual millionaire. Welcome to the Consumerism Commentary Podcast. I'm Luke Landis. Today's guest is Jamie Tardy, the author of Eventual Millionaire, the blog, and Eventual Millionaire, How Anyone Can Be an Entrepreneur and Successfully Grow Their Startup, a book, available at Amazon.com and other retailers. Jamie, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Luke.
What is it about being a millionaire that is so aspirational for people?
It's so funny. It's that extra comma, right, that does everything that makes it so absolutely amazing. It is kind of a silly, arbitrary goal as far as why, you know, not 999,000, why a million. But it is that point where we can pick out as if that is success. That extra digit sort of means to make a big difference in people's lives. I mean, ever since I was a little girl, I wanted to be a millionaire too. And I know so many other people sort of hone that in as a huge goal to be able to have.
But what does it mean having that extra comma? Does it really change your life?
Exactly. No. I mean, that's the thing. A mutual friend of ours who came on my show, Todd Tressiter from financialmentor.com, he told me on the show that hitting that $1 million net worth actually led to one of the most unhappy periods of his life. And the reason why was because he thought, you know, that made a difference. That comma, that extra digit really made a difference. And he was under that assumption the entire time. But when he realized and he hit it, he said the reason why he was so unhappy is because before he was unhappy because he hadn't hit that number. Now that he hit that number, he had to really look at everything else in his life, because if he wasn't happy, it was all on him.
Between, you know, the lack of there being some sort of a change when you hit a specific number like that, and also the fact that $1 million isn't really enough of a net worth or investable net worth to make you financially independent, at least for people who want to live like a middle class lifestyle, does it even make sense to encourage people to still look at the millionaire status as being something that, you know, is can be an ultimate goal?
I agree with you. Number one, it should not be an ultimate goal. The problem is that a lot of people have issues even thinking that big, right? And so really, to me, it's the first step. I need $3.5 million by the time I retire in order to live, you know, about $50,000 a year. So money now with inflation, everything, a millionaire is definitely not what it used to be. And doing all these interviews, it's funny. The people that only have about a net worth of $1 million, $2 million, $3 million, are pretty middle class, to tell you the truth. And the ones that are, you know, 10 million plus, those are the ones with the Lamborghinis or the really nice houses or something like that. So $1 million definitely is not what it used to be. But the reason why I think it's really important to be focusing on that as a goal, because they all say, right, the first million is the hardest. So really getting your mind, wrapping your mind around that, because most of the people I talk to, even if they're my age and need, you know, $3 million, think that a million is so big that they could never attain it. And when we start thinking like that, well, of course, we're never going to be able to get to 3 million. So really having that very first subset of goal of, yeah, I want to be a millionaire, sounds kind of cool. People are all attracted to that. Yeah, I want to be a millionaire. Later, you have to hit them with the fact that that's not going to be enough anyway. But at least that gives you the upfront push towards something that you can see as a worthwhile goal.
So you're kind of saying that it's the psychology that makes the first million the difficult million to achieve. Is there something more than just getting over the idea that it's a number that makes it difficult?
Well, I mean, there's so many things, especially because way back when it was worth so much more, right? So I did some data, there's some information in the book, and it's something like in 1950s dollars, if you think about it today, that's only about $200,000. So the fact $1 million would only get you that much is nothing, right? Mm-hmm. Unfortunately. So when you start thinking about it that way, and think of the way our parents or grandparents thought of $1 million as being this huge thing, it's because they thought it was a huge thing that we still think it's a huge thing, even if It's not. And so not only psychologically of really making sure that, yeah, we need to be able to get past that, but our conditioning as kids as like, oh my gosh, this is absolutely an amazing feat. Oh my, my parents personally never in a million years and still to this day don't have anywhere near a million, even though they need it for retirement. And that sucks, right? And so if they've always told me, oh my gosh, $1 million, blah, blah, blah. Well, yeah, that's hardcore set in beliefs that you have to get past, which is tough, especially at first.
You've wanted to be a millionaire since you were young, as you mentioned. And you decided at some point as an adult that you needed to change your course. You decided that money wasn't important, so you experimented with some business ideas according to your book. What happened at that point? Did you start making money right away?
No, definitely not. Well, the problem was I was in corporate. And since money was so important to me when I was younger, my parents didn't have a lot of money. So for some reason, that made it really important to me about going, okay, I have to go to good school, get a really good job. And by the time I was 22, I made right at $100,000. I made low six figures, which to me was amazing. Unfortunately, I hated it. So that wasn't very helpful. That really sort of shined the beacon on when you go after the money and you don't control your own life. Well, that's not what it's about. So when I remember quitting, I like to say, and I say this in the book, that, you know, if I continued at that job, I would have been a millionaire way faster, right? And mm-hmm. So, but if I died the day before I became a millionaire, would that have been worth it? Well, hell no. Not if I hated every second of it.
Sure.
So to me, it was more about, and that's sort of the point of eventual millionaire. It's not about just the $1 million. It's about enjoying the life that you have. So I like to say that an eventual millionaire is someone who has the goal to be a millionaire eventually, but wants to do it on their own terms with an enjoyable life and an enjoyable business.
Okay, but with a six-figure job at age 22, and you were also married, so you probably had some income from your husband as well, that gave you a lot of flexibility to be able to decide to just quit your job and start a business, right?
Not exactly. I was a breadwinner, and my husband was a juggler, professional juggler.
Okay, all right.
So he had a variable income, wasn't making all that much money, and I'm like, oh, shoot, I have the stable job. How am I going to quit my job? Because mm-hmm. at that point, I mean, looking at history, I mean, I looked for any blogs that talked about being the woman, being the breadwinner, and wanting to quit whose husband was a performer, right? This was, mm-hmm. I was like, you know, looking at the bottom, I'm at the bottom of a mountain looking straight up going, yeah, I have no idea how I'm going to get there. And so, I mean, unfortunately and fortunately, I guess, we definitely figured it out. But we were also, that money sounds really great, but we were in $70,000 in debt. So it wasn't as though like we were making the best choices with it either. Mm. So it's not like we had a ton of savings. Oh, yeah, I'll quit and start my business and it'll be wonderful.
So there was some risk there for you that you were accepting when you did that.
Huge, to me, huge. So I spent, before I quit, we wanted to have a baby too, so I kind of had to quit because my job, I used to leave on Monday and come home on Friday. And I'm like, I can't do that with a baby. So trying to figure out what the heck I could do was really important, and also a huge timetable because I got pregnant and was like, oh, shoot, I really have to figure this out. So we paid off the $70,000 in debt by working our butts off, selling the car that was a big chunk of that debt, a whole bunch of other things that we tried to do. So we got rid of that in about 16 months. And my son was about 4 months old when I quit my job. And so that was great. That sounds like a wonderful story. But when I quit, I was like, oh, shoot, now what do I do? Which is not a good idea, just so you know. Now, thankfully, my husband started making more. We were really concentrating on getting his level of income up. And now he makes way more than, you know, this was 7 years ago. So thankfully.
Is he still a juggler, though?
He's a performer. So he's a contortionist and has a show called Audio Body, which is like technology and music. And it's an amazing show. He does shows at Disney Cruise Lines and a whole bunch of them. It performed at the White House 3 times. So there, I call him a juggler. He hates it when I say that. He's always like, you're calling me a juggler. They do amazing work. They're kind of like Blue Man Group, him and his brother.
Oh, wow. And sounds fantastic.
It is utterly amazing. I should not ever say, oh, he's just a juggler. By the time, that's all he was doing. And there, I mean, we knew he was capable of so much more. And so thankfully, we definitely worked on that. So having that other income stream, even if it was variable, he was really working a lot in the summer and then not working a lot in the winter. So as people know, dealing with budgeting, and that is a pain in the butt. So when I quit my job, thankfully, we had saved an emergency fund of about 6 months. So I was like, okay, worst comes to worst, I quit, have no money at all for 6 months and I stay home with the baby and maybe I can figure out how to make money in that time. Now, don't get me wrong. I do not recommend that. I do not quit your job without any sort of idea on what to do. But it was, I think, what we needed to do definitely at the time.
In some ways, quitting without financial backup, well, although you had 6 months emergency fund and anyone would be in a great position if they quit with that ready to go, but jumping without a safety net raises the stakes so that if you're the type of person who reacts to this well, you can use the stress to your advantage. The fact that you have to, do something or else you will have to go back to your old corporate life could motivate some people towards success and determination. But what you're saying is that most people should have a plan.
Definitely. So it's funny because I had read about that and I thought people who quit their job without anything to go to were kind of crazy at first, right? Like, oh gosh, because I'm a planner just in general. And so doing something like that seemed like a little bit much. Now, don't get me wrong. I had a little, I did some freelance project management work at first. So with some friends of mine, that was probably like 5, maybe 10 hours a week. So I had something. And because we made our expenses so low, that made sense, right? So thankfully it wasn't, I wasn't that, I mean, I was still really stressed, don't get me wrong, but that's not actually the type of person I am. I don't react well to that type of pressure. Now, don't get me wrong. I sort of was like, oh shoot, I better do this. But I didn't really figure out the business side of things for probably 2 years. Thankfully, like I said, our expenses were so low and we were able to get my husband's income a little bit better. So it wasn't too bad, but it still wasn't fun. I mean, especially the lady who wanted to make have $1 million net worth, not making a lot of money, just scrimping to get by for 2 years wasn't very fun either. And I talk about that in the book, but I mean, don't get me wrong. It gave me the time to be able to really work on something and build a foundation for what I have right now, which is really good. Now I've interviewed millionaires and some of them would be like, oh, I just left my job and knew I, you know, only had this much runway. I had 3 months. I had to figure something out. I'm like, oh God, you know, please don't tell my people to do that because that's hard. Right. And that's a lot of pressure and a lot of stress on your family, especially if you have a family.
Absolutely.
So that sort of stuff is really tough. I highly recommend, you know, a side hustle is the best thing in the entire world, even though it's tough. It's more tough to, you know, not be able to make any money and, you know, have to pay your mortgage.
You said something about the concept of the eventual millionaire being first figuring out the life that you want to live. And you write about designing your lifestyle in the book. What does that mean to design your lifestyle?
Well, I just see a lot of people not realizing what they want. Right. And now don't get me wrong. We kind of have to guess at what we want before we actually get there, which is tough. Right. I can say I want to be a public speaker. And actually, I did say this before I did the book. I'm like, I really want to do more public speaking. Funny thing is, I also don't like being away from my family all that much. So those two things don't really work very well together. Right. Mm-hmm. Most public speakers, when they're doing really well, making good money, are gone, constantly traveling. And so those two things didn't align. And a lot of the times when we start a business, we're like, okay, great. What's my passion? Or, you know, how can I make money fast? Those are usually the two defaults that people think of. And instead, what I want people to start thinking of is what do they want their life to look like later? When we start figuring out what we want our life to look like, that's when things become a little bit more clear. Right. So the example in the book is, you know, if you want to start a business and you're like, I've always wanted to own an organic farm, and yet you hate waking up early or you hate, you know, putting in long hours or something like that, and you don't have any money to start because a farm's going to cost you a lot of cash up front.
Sure.
That's not really the best business idea that you should be moving forward on. So I just want to take everything into account when you make that, you know, all important decision on what you're going to spend your time and money invested in for a business.
Yeah, what you're saying about passion makes sense, I think. You can't rely on just passion to build your wealth, but if you can find an intersection between your passion, your skills, and a market need, like you say, that seems to be the sweet spot for finding success and fulfillment.
Exactly. And that can be difficult, especially if you're, you know, sitting on your couch twiddling your thumbs going, what do I don't know. Like the options are endless. What do I pick? It's really difficult to do. So that's why I have in the book sort of, and I've asked tons of millionaires on how they got their ideas and how they decided that they were worth pursuing and all that sort of stuff too. So that way we can sort of break it down a little bit more. So it's not as though you just have to be sitting there by yourself trying to come up with these ideas that are going to be perfect for your life. You're not going to know. And I also like to say that you're you're not going to know. So maybe you try something and you're like, oh, shoot, that's not what I want. Mm-hmm. That's okay, too. That's just life.
So you have interviewed over 100 millionaires for your book and your blog. I looked at the numbers. One study from last year said there were 5.2 million millionaires in the United States. Another research firm said that there are 6.5 millionaire households. There are a lot of them out there. How do you choose which millionaires you are interested in speaking with for your book or your blog?
So I love this. You're the first interviewer that actually said, hey, yeah, there's a lot of millionaires out there. How do you pick? Because most people are like, oh my gosh, how did you meet any? How did you find one? Right? Because at first I didn't know any whatsoever. So, I mean, mm-hmm. I come from a small town in Maine and, you know, people aren't just like raising their hands saying they're millionaires anywhere right. near me. So it is funny. What I did was I ended up finding people. I wanted people that were business owners. I mean, I'm a business coach. I really wanted to work with people, not only because of that, but because, I mean, your people have probably read Millionaire Next Door. They say that being a business owner is one of the best ways, one of the top surveyed ways that they've become millionaires. And so knowing that, knowing how many people want to start businesses, it just made sense for me to start interviewing millionaires. So what I like to do now, thankfully, I get people coming to me. You know, I've had millionaires call me on the phone going, hey, will you interview me? And what we have to do is we have to sort of run them through a bit of a process, right? So I do some verification of making sure that they have a net worth of at least $1 million. And right now I'm looking for more women and more minorities because mm-hmm. to tell you the truth, the ones that I found at the very beginning were all white men pretty much. And so now I'm truly trying to get some diversity into it and stuff like that too. And I've been introduced to a bunch of different people that way to try and find out some other stories. But the stories are so vast. It's so funny to look at this scope of the people that I'm interviewing. So one person, his name is Craig Wolf. He has a company called Celebridux and he makes rubber duckies that look like celebrities. Right. And this is like a $3 million company or something like that. And I chatted with him last week. It's just so funny to sort of see the range. I mean, and there's definitely, you know, the normal kind of, you know, investment advisor, they own their own business or something like that. There's definitely those, but it really runs the gamut. And I want to show people that, you know, they come from all walks of life and it's not just, you know, a guru that wrote a book that tells you how he did it. I wanted to know how people that were actually running their businesses, doing really well, did it too.
When you were working in your previous job, you said that one of the problems you had when you were working there in a corporation, you were thinking about how you're spending your time, was that you wanted to matter. And I took that to mean that you wanted your work and the time you were spending to matter. But when I was working for a corporation, I felt the same way. I knew I wanted to be doing more important things with my time and that my skills could probably lead me elsewhere in life. But we can't have every employee leaving their corporate jobs in search of working for a higher cause, right?
Well, what's funny is you think of the people, like I think of the people that I worked with before, and a lot of them are happy. So that's the funny thing. It's not as though we're going to have this amazing, crazy revolution. Some people are meant for corporate. I want to talk to the people who know that they're not meant for corporate. Because when I was little, I used to do entrepreneurial things, right? And I think what's really interesting is we sort of push that down because that seems risky or something like that. And so what I want to do is start trying to bring that out in people and go, no, 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 you can definitely do it. And in fact, it might not be as risky as doing a corporate job because people are getting laid off. We want to be able to make sure that the options are all out on the table before you make that decision instead of just going, oh yeah, that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to go into corporate. Does that make sense?
Yeah, in fact, this ties into a conversation I had on the podcast with Kimberly Palmer recently. We talked about the same thing, how not everyone is destined to be an entrepreneur and how culture has changed so much in this country. It used to be you would work for the same company for 30 years or more, making a career out of life, and loyalty goes both ways. We see a lot more people interested in the idea of entrepreneurship recently.
Which makes sense, right? So if you've gotten fired or laid off or whatever, and you're like, oh, shoot, I don't know if that's the best way, or your company starts to, and then you start to get stressed when you really have no control over whether or not they're going to keep you. I mean, that stuff's tough. Being able to really be in control. I'm a control freak too, so that might be one of the reasons, but being in control of your own destiny and your own future is really important to people nowadays, whether or not they started in corporate.
Sure, and still there's a risk with entrepreneurship. You may be in charge of the company, but you still have people you need to answer to. You have your clients, you have to be aware of the economy, and you have to be aware of your market. You're never totally in control when you own your own business.
No, definitely not. As you go in through as being a business owner, you're not. But the thing is that I feel like the risk is a bit more mitigated, right? So it's not as though you're a corporation and, you know, you get fired and that's it. You can start trying to pay attention to the trends. If you see the economy going down, you can make adjustments. You can start trying to figure stuff out instead of necessarily just having one point of failure. You have quite a few points of failure, which is tough to manage sometimes, but at least you have a little bit more control on paying attention to those. And you have more data and information on that sort of side of things too.
Instead of millionaires, if we were talking about decamillionaires, $10 million to invest, or ultra high net worth individuals or households, those were $50 million. We always talk about the millionaires next door, and we know that these millionaires don't advertise their wealth such as it is. They drive non-flashy cars. Would we be talking about different strategies if we forgot the millionaires and instead focused on people with considerable wealth?
That's a really good question. I wanted to know, too, because when you interview them, it's a big difference, like I said before, on people that are decamillionaires versus people that, you know, only have a couple million dollars net worth. And it's funny because there's someone like Frank McKinney. Now, I don't know exactly his net worth, but I know he sells, you know, $50 million dream homes. Like, that's what they do. They build $50 million dream homes. He calls himself a real estate daredevil.
So whether or not he's ultra high net worth, he's dealing with clients who are.
Totally. And I'm pretty sure he is quite high net worth. He's been doing this for a very long time. I don't know exactly what at this point, but he's more of a decamillionaire, I would think, than one of the beginning people. But the interesting thing is that I think they really pay attention to what they value. So like with Frank, he doesn't really care about cars very much. So he drives a Yugo, which is kind of silly, but he does care about other things. Or like MJ DeMarco, who wrote a book called The Millionaire Fastlane. Mm-hmm. He sold limos.com. He used to have a whole business on that. And the interesting thing with what he does is on the cover of the book, he had a Lamborghini, right? Because he was all about cars, cared about them all the time. He has a great forum online too, where people want to become millionaires. And the funny thing is after a while, he ended up selling the Lamborghini because he's like, you know what? I'm not sure that I really care about having a crazy car anymore. And so like interesting stuff like that, they really pay attention to what they value. So yeah, if they value that stuff, then of course they're going to get it, right? Jay Leno has a bazillion cars for a reason. He loves them. But in other times, they might not care as much. So it doesn't mean they're not going to get a Lamborghini because they have the cash. It just means they're really paying attention to what they value.
One of the suggestions in your book for helping people make the most out of their money deals with anticipation. You write about how anticipation can make you happier by paying now, consuming later. What does that mean exactly, and how does that make you feel that you're getting better use out of your money?
Definitely. Okay. So for something like, let's say you save up all your money and then you buy a vacation, right? And you're like, ooh, I'm super excited. That anticipation from, but you haven't even spent the money yet, right? You just have it sitting there waiting and you know that you're going to be going on this vacation at a certain time. Like that is an experience that you can't get in any other way, which is exciting. And you're almost getting more of that experience than you would in other ways, right? So if I went to buy a car, thankfully with cash the other day, right? And so I was super excited the whole entire time, even though that cash was sitting there and waiting, and I know that's what the car was for, having that length of time in between and going, I could buy whatever car I want. What car do I want? Let me go down this. Let me figure this out. It was really fun instead of the opposite, right? Which is what most people are doing, buying things on credit and then feeling guilty afterwards. I mean, the sort of full circle story that I have, if you read the book, you heard that I bought a car $70,000, about $19,000 of it was a brand new Honda Civic that we had just bought and financed the entire thing. And I remember feeling horribly guilty, like, oh my gosh, half my debt is because of this car. That was such a bad decision, right? And like I said, the funny thing is just a couple days ago, I just bought a Honda Civic for about that price with cash. And I feel no guilt whatsoever. And it was really, really fun and amazing to be able to know that you have that and can really go through and make best choices with it. So really being able to have that and use that anticipation factor. It's just like Christmas, right? So you look forward to Christmas, even if you got the crappiest gift at Christmas, that whole month of Christmas, you're so excited. And use that to the best advantage that you can, because that's stuff that doesn't cost any more money at all, but it makes us happy because of it.
And on the opposite side, you talk about low self-esteem in the book as well. Does that play into someone's ability to grow their wealth?
I believe 1,000%, which is really interesting, especially dealing with business owners. You can really tell the ones that have some mindset issues in general. The people that don't think they're worth more in their business do not charge more, do not make more, right? So those are huge pieces, not only if you're in business, if you're still in corporate, asking for a raise. If you don't think that you're worth it, then you're not going to get it.
Sure.
And so really starting to build those pieces of your own self-worth and self-esteem. There's a great book called The 7 Pillars of Self-Esteem. I highly recommend it. Really sort of looks in a mirror. Sometimes it's hard to look in a mirror, right? Mm-hmm. And so it really looks in that mirror on if you have self-esteem issues and what do you do to tangibly, because there's all this woo-woo stuff too. You know what I mean? How do you tangibly increase your self-esteem and your self-worth? And that's a great book to be able to do that.
Are millionaires more self-confident than other people?
Yes. And it doesn't mean that they were at first. That's the one thing that I have to say. A lot of them really tell stories of, you know, low self-worth, but they, like I said, worked through it and really tried investing in themselves. But now when I look at the 130 plus that I've interviewed, it really is astounding to see how much confidence they have. And don't get me wrong, a lot of it can come after too, like, woohoo, I'm successful, I'm very confident about that. Look at me, I already did it. But I think as they were going through and listening to their stories as they were going through, their self-esteem kept getting better and better and better, especially for those ones that started off with really low self-esteem.
So Jamie, are you a millionaire now?
No, that's the thing. One of my end goals was to try, or not end goals, one of my goals was to see what I could do while being a mom. So I, for the length of my business, right, have been working maybe 20 or 30 hours a week. And now don't get me wrong, I'm an entrepreneur. I would love to work 24 hours a day. So it's very, very difficult. And so it's been hard because a lot of people have been asking me, well, are you a millionaire yet? And I'm like, no, I'm not. I want to make sure that that's not what the book is about.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because it is, don't get me wrong, eventually it is, but I could be a millionaire so much. I mean, I could have been if I decided to work 40, 50, 60 plus hours a week. When I interviewed the millionaires, I did a survey for the book and I asked them at the beginning of their business, how many hours a week did they work? And the most common answer was all of them. Which was sad because that wasn't even a choice on there. They all wrote that in on their own. And so I'm not willing to do that right now where I am with my family, right? And so sure. It's going to take me longer. And I'm okay with that, even though sometimes it's annoying. I like to move quickly. But no, I'm not yet. I'm an eventual millionaire.
Is there anything you do differently now based on what you've learned from the millionaires that you've spoken with? I'm talking about in your own life, in your own processes, that sort of thing.
Definitely. 1,000 times over, especially when they give me really good business advice. We chat sometimes offline afterwards and they give me really great business advice. So I've got the best job in the world, right? Interviewing millionaires. No, but there's a lot of different pieces and parts, and even just seeing what they do and how they interact. And I've become friends with a lot of them. Thankfully, I'm very, very lucky that a lot of them are really good friends of mine now, and to be able to see them both sides, I should say, mm-hmm. You know, not just the, hey, I'm on an interview and I sound great and everything is amazing and wonderful. Like, besides that side of things too, but it's the other side of them going, well, I'm not really sure and I'm scared and that sort of stuff. And it really hones in on what do they do when they're scared and what do they do during those times that are harder. And that stuff really helps me out too.
What is one of the things that they do when they are dealing with their fears?
Ooh, I was just asking my good friend Sean Malarkey about this too. I have a whole chapter on fear in the book, and it's really interesting to have them open up and talk about it. And I know this is true for my friends too that are millionaires also, but really being able to recognize that it's fear, right? Instead of just, you know, procrastination or excuses or, you know what I mean? Because we can cover up our fears in all sorts of different ways. But recognizing that it's a fear And then it's something that you just have to move through anyway. And so Sean specifically, I asked him again, I did a webinar with 8 millionaires this past week, and somebody asked, well, how do you get past your fear? And he's like, I don't, I just keep moving forward, right? The fear is always there. It's not as though I can, you know, sidestep it or get past it in any way. I feel it and I still keep moving forward, even if it's scary. And so that's the best tip I have. Know that A, you're not alone. Everybody's scared. And B, what you have to do is not let that stop you.
Great. I think that's a great note to end on today. Jamie, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Luke. I really appreciate it.
That was Jamie Tardy, author of Eventual Millionaire, How Anyone Can Be an Entrepreneur and Successfully Grow Their Startup, the new book available on Amazon.com. You can find more information on Jamie's website, eventualmillionaire.com.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of the Consumerism Commentary Podcast. We welcome your feedback. Please email us at podcast@consumerismcommentary.com. To subscribe to the podcast or to listen to this or other episodes, visit us at consumerismcommentary.com/pod or search for Consumerism Commentary on iTunes. The Consumerism Commentary Podcast is hosted and produced by Tom Dubeck, Brian J. Bush, and Luke Landis. The music is composed and performed by Mindcube. The podcast was founded by Luke Landis.